Hello and welcome to the Beyond Shakespeare podcast. I'm your host, Robert Crichton, General Overseer of the podcast, which specialises in creating full cast audio adaptations of drama from before 1642, as well as providing background and other production resources. You can support our work and get a say in what we produce by becoming a patron today. Go to www.patreon.com/beyondshakespeare. Anyway, today I'm delighted to be joined by Sam Plum, director of a production of Jack Drum's Entertainment by John Marston.
Hello, I'm Sam. I am a theatre director based now in Cambridge, and I do a lot of work with youth theatre groups.
Sam is a director and teacher for the Young Actors Company, and the performance of Jack Drum's Entertainment was performed by their students. And we are doubly blessed because not only did they stage it, they filmed it as well! Yay! Now, it's not NT Live, but the audio is clear, and it isn't a single locked-off camera. There are different angles. And it's on YouTube now. Links in the show notes. The only part of the play not in the recording, beyond a number of cuts, is the introduction, which I'm delighted to be able to share with you now as a little aperitif to this episode before we talk to Sam. So, the introduction. It's called the introduction in the printed text, but usually these things are called inductions, so I don't know if there's any variance on that that goes around. I don't know. Anyway, it's really fun. It's a typical bit of pre-show business for Marston, suggesting that the play the audience has come to see has been stolen by an intemperate playwright. Possibly this is satire, not precisely sure of what. And the early modern equivalent of the stage manager, the tireman, the person in charge of the tire house, presumably, comes out to say, we might have to see something of a bit of a cabaret mash-up instead of a proper play, a John Drum entertainment. He exits, and then one of the child performers comes out to say that this isn't quite true.
In God's faith, gentlemen, I think we shall be forced to give you right John Drum's entertainment. For he that composed the book we should present hath done us very vehement wrong. He hath snatched it from us upon the very instance of entrance, and with violence keeps the boys from coming on the stage. So, God help me, if we wrong your delights, 'tis infinitely against our endeavours, unless we should make a tumult in the tiring house.
You much mistake his action, tire man. His violence proceeds nor from a mind that grudgeth pleasure to this generous presence, but doth protest all due respect and love unto this choice selected influence. He vows, if he could draw the music from the spheres, to entertain this presence with delight, or could distill the quintessence of heaven in rare composed scenes and sprinkle them among your ears. This industry should sweat to sweeten your delights. But he was loath, wanting a prologue, and ourselves not perfect, to rush upon your eyes without respect. Yet if you'll pardon his defects and ours, he'll give us passage and you pleasing scenes, and vows not to torment your listening ears with mouldy fopperies of stale poetry, impossible dry musty fictions. And for our parts, to gratify your favour, we'll study till our cheeks look wan with care, that you our pleasures, we your loves may share.
And that was Rob Myson as the tire man, and myself as a small boy. And that was how the play started in 1599-1600-ish. So how did it come about in 2016? So now, here's an occasionally a little bit sweary and digressy chat with Sam Plum, recorded in the summer of 2019, as evidenced by an occasional glimpse in the sound of an ice cream van.
Excellent.
Lovely.
So, having worked with some youth
in
the Young Actors Company,
yeah.
and you did Jack Drum's Entertainment. Now, how did that come about?
Well, I was doing a PhD at UCL on classical receptions within Milton, specifically classical receptions of Orpheus. and I started to get really bored because I was doing, because I'm more of a sort of theatre maker, really. I was sort of pretending to be an academic. And then I decided that I would try to find a way of doing stuff with drama, because I was aware of groups like Edward's Boys, run by Perry Mills.
Yes.
And I was aware the Globe Young Players were a thing.
Mm.
They had their second year of two
yes.
when I was doing my Milton stuff. And so I'd seen their work, and I'd also taught in youth theatre before, and I was like, oh, maybe I can make a string of PhD out of this kind of thing. Mm. I spoke to some other potential supervisors at UCL, Helen Hackett particularly, and Lucy Munro at King's, actually, in the end. And they said that they would take me on, and they let me choose the play. And so I asked around. I emailed people like Martin Wiggins and spoke to my supervisors, obviously, and we ended up thinking that Marston would be a good idea. We knew there was the Marston project going on, so we thought that might be a good thing to overlap with. I read a few. I thought Jack Drum would be cool because I knew a composer, and there are all those lyrics that survive in Jack Drum, and I hadn't had, so far as I could tell from my Googling, any attempts to stage it recently.
Well, I'm looking at the John Marston Leeds website for the Marston project.
Yeah.
So without a professional production in more than 400 years, allegedly.
Mm.
Please, if you have done a production of your own and you think this is all lies, tell us, because you'd be, every time someone pops up somewhere saying, oh no, we did it. Sam Plum's team of young actors discovered a celebration of love full of opportunities for clowning and music.
I know, I'm so pleased we made it onto their website.
Yes.
Yes! It worked.
Well, it was recorded, your production was recorded in Oxford when it was performed there.
Yeah.
And it's a multi-camera recording. It's clear.
Mm.
The sound is not shit.
Mm.
So for those who have tried looking at productions of things on YouTube, which are usually single camera, face in the front, sound mostly being with someone whispering underneath. This is actually watchable.
Yeah, hopefully
and
not
really
too exhausting to watch. That's the idea.
Well, it's 2 hours, and you did make cuts.
Yes.
But they are quite logical cuts, as far as I could see. I was conferring the script, because I mean, my relationship with Jack Drum, I have read the play.
Very good.
In the distant, distant past.
Yeah.
And the thing about reading a play, especially a play like this, as we're going to explain to the listener, is that it does not come across what it actually is. The script does not immediately declare itself to you as the beast that it is. Because you sort of try and read it like a conventional play, and it really isn't a conventional play in many, many ways. It's much more, shall we say, experimental.
Yeah.
It does what a lot of Marston does, which is fuck about with conventions and styles and genres.
Yeah.
And the question of what is this entertainment? And I think that's a very important word.
Yeah, yeah.
So, sum up, if you could describe, because we haven't really tried to even describe, what is this play by John Marston? John Marston, who was writing for boys' companies mostly, though moving later on into other companies for the adult companies, and adapting his own work or having his work adapted for later performance. Malcontent goes through various contortions. So he's working with the boys' companies. He's working for a very specific set of people, and so tell us about this play.
Oh wow! Like in terms of the plot. Yeah. I mean, it's been a while since I've tried to summarise the plot, so I'm going to do a terrible job. But this is actually great, because maybe you're going to help me understand the play, because I completely agree with what you're saying. I still don't think I really understand it. Mm. So you have Fortune, Master mm-hmm. Fortune, or in our production, Lady Fortune, who has two daughters, Camellia and Katerina.
I think I'm right in saying.
Yeah, you're doing Camellia and Catherine.
Yes, Catherine, mm. sometimes called Katerina.
Katerina, yeah. Well, that opens up a whole can of worms, which we probably can't discuss. but yes.
Camellia, as her name might suggest, is kind of fairly fickle and changeable, mm-hmm. and has multiple suitors, and so does Catherine.
Mm.
But Catherine is in love with Pasquill.
Which isn't that an alternative title for the play, actually, the love of Pasquill and Catherine?
Ah, yes.
So in the sense, you could argue
yeah.
that this is the primary plot.
Yes.
I'm not going to, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
But you could reframe it as that.
Yes, and so, but there's another suitor for Catherine, and that's Mammon the Usurer,
mm.
Who may be Jewish? Sort of not May... entirely clear.
Okay, that I hadn't picked up
There's
on.
There's sort of potential Jewishness with Mammon.
Okay, good. Nice to get the anti-Semitism question in.
Yes. I'm pretty sure the word Jewry features.
Yeah. Doesn't he curse Jews?
He curses
at
on
one
Jewry,
point?
He's like in an interesting role in relation to Jewishness, but I don't know.
He's called Mammon for, you know, the obvious reason that he is, you know, money is
yes.
one of his primary drivers.
He's meant to be old and very greedy.
Yeah, yeah. And we could go back to classical antiquity of, you know, the mm. old lecherous money obsessed man.
Yeah, yeah.
Who's determined to get himself a hottie.
Yes, exactly.
In exchange for lots and lots of money. But the father of the two daughters, Sir Edward Fortune.
Yeah.
Seems quite open about with, you know, they're going to get money, and he doesn't, they have some freedom of movement. Am I misinterpreting that?
Yes, no, they're gonna, he's gonna give them a fortune,
mm.
I think, like, yeah.
So they have some room for manoeuvre. It's not like they're being sold off.
No.
In which you get in other plays.
No, and he wants
way.
His daughter to marry for love as
yeah.
well. He's very
which
specific
is
about
radical,
that.
Radical concept.
Yeah, what a guy.
So Catherine is in love with...
Pasquill. Yeah.
I love these strange names.
That's yeah.
Right. And that's a straightforward... Or could appear at first hand a straightforward love story.
Yeah.
In fact, perhaps very... deliberately, conventionally expressed love story. And then you have Mammon as the figure in getting in the way.
Yeah.
And then we have lots of other sort of variations on a theme.
Comic wooers
yeah.
popping in. Monsieur Snuff, who is... Master Puff, right?
Puff, yes.
Yes, Puff and his page. So Puff smokes,
mm-hmm.
one of Marston's smokers. And so,
as tobacco is just coming in to vogue
yeah.
in the period, there's quite a lot of back and forth about tobacco going on.
And I think specifically tobacco inside in an indoor theatre, where it produces kind of clouds and is quite like noticeable.
Mm.
I'm actually I really want to know what went on there, like how what kind of tobacco they used in a show, because they've really got through it and how they would have created all that smoke. But,
because in your production, you've got
We use a bubble pipe.
So it's there's a control, because there's a thing about the controlling of it going out
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And thinking, you know, with bubbles, it's relatively easy to produce bubbles on
yeah.
command.
Yes.
But
yeah.
getting the impression of a pipe going out or not.
Yeah, we did fail at that. That's
well, no, really it worked with the bubbles. I'm wondering for. In an original staging context,
yeah,
how that's managed. I mean, I assume they just sort of fudged it through the dialogue and you know, that it was probably never really properly lit ever, because pipes are never properly lit. They just go out. That's what they do.
Well, I think even in this one, like, because it's quite an early one for the reformed St. Paul's Boys. Mm. I think it's possibly their second, because they've just done Antonio and Melida,
yeah.
and then they do this.
Another
and
play by John Marston.
Yeah, and then they do this, and then they do Antonio's Revenge, I think,
yeah.
potentially.
Yeah, so we've got these three plays coming in relatively quick succession, and nobody's 100% certain of the ordering, but it doesn't really matter.
But so it's early for Marston, but despite that, and despite the fact that these are presumably less experienced, even for boy actors, there does seem to be a thing
asking
of like
a lot.
Of intentionally throwing them things which will potentially go wrong.
Yeah.
Like there are obviously always the inductions. So there's an induction in this production which we cut.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that because we'll probably record it.
Oh, great.
Yeah, we'll probably do that to go with this when this goes out.
Which is indeed what we did, as you heard earlier.
And then there's things like smoking, and all the songs. There's loads of stuff that can go wrong. And a French character.
Yes, I was going to say, let's continue going through the characters.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a cuckolding theme. So again, going almost back to classical roots. And one always wonders with boy companies whether there's almost a deliberate connection with things that they might be learning at the same time. And there's an interesting aside, which I'll come back to later. But yes, talk us through the comedy Frenchman. Comedy foreigners.
Yes.
Marston does a few of those.
Yeah.
He does it in the Dutch courtesan as well, with Dutch.
He's so odd. So he's called John Foda King. John for the King. And he has a few songs, which were really fun to compose for. And he's full of sort of syphilis, I think, some kind of venereal disease, because he's always described himself as very hot and on fire with lust, and he's also trying to woo Catherine, repeatedly, but he's quite a harmless kind of cartoon, really, yeah.
Because there's the unfortunate who manages to organise his own cuckolding,
yes,
with said Frenchman.
Yes, that's right, Brabant Senior.
Mm.
Yeah, okay, so you've got the Brabant brothers. Oh, it's all flooding
There's
back.
So many characters, this is the thing. There's, 16 characters in total.
Yeah, it's great.
And
it's
they
kind
are
of great.
All doing things.
That's one of the reasons I chose it, I think, was because I wanted something that felt kind of... It feels very democratic and egalitarian in terms of part distribution. When you say there's no lead plot, I think that's one of the reasons. But So Brabant Jr., one of the Brabant brothers, is the true suitor of Camellia. And then his older brother, yes, gets cuckolded. Brabant has a wife. And the wife is ultimately the one that John Foda King ends up, after trying just basically to have sex with anything that moves, he eventually gets set up with Brabant's wife, and that all goes well, sort of off stage, and then Brabant Senior gets to wear the cuckold's horns at the end, and that's
he comes out just at the end after the epic song, which we must talk about at length. And he just sort of goes, well, I've played this merry jape on, you know, I've told him my wife is a courtesan who is up for sale. But of course she will rebuff him, and he sort of comes on going,
yeah,
she was great, mate.
Yeah, yeah.
The wart that she, and you, I'm sorry, I think you placed the wart in a very... So in the video of the production, you can see they sort of indicate it was probably around her breast.
Yes.
I suspect it was a slightly more intimate.
Yes, it could have been more intimate.
But they were children.
They were a bit young. And also, I didn't know the cast very well. So it was a really getting to know each other production. Mm. It was quite interesting in terms of we were quite paralleled, I imagined, how Marston felt with his students at the time. It was my first time working with that group.
But I have to say, the group, I mean, the dynamic of the group and the dynamic in the video really comes across. It's fun, there's energy to it, and they do work together. And you've got different sort of ages and therefore slightly different skills going on. But you seem to have got the best out of them, which is, it does come across.
And you have another key character, just while we're going through characters. So the friend, a good friend of Brabant Jr., if you can call him that, is a sort of cynic called Planet, Master Planet, who is just kind of enjoying watching everyone get into these romantic tussles and commenting cynically on them.
Because one of the themes of the whole thing is all about variations on love and lust, and you know, with those, that sort of wooing contest, you almost have these wooing back-to-back wooing scenes where the satire element of the show really comes to the fore. The absurdity of love comes through really well. Now, of course, there's one character we haven't mentioned at all, because they're the title character.
Right, yeah.
And this is the thing. Jack Drum
is
sort of peripheral.
Yes.
almost as a levelling character, as just something that just breaks action up. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I wonder if you know, we could have done far more with Jack Drum and Timothy Tweedle, who are these kind of servant characters to Sir Edward Fortune. And so, yeah, Jack Drum is kind of, I think he's kind of feels like a butler or something. And Timothy Tweedle is like a more elderly serving staff figure. Mm. And they're there right at the start after the Tire Man's induction, kind of expositioning our way into the debate, the kind of conversation between Fortune and Mammon. Mm. And then they come in at intervals to sort of talk about stuff.
and it's the way the action is punctuated by music and those sort of interjections, which is where we should get to the point of, you know, what is the entertainment element of this. It feels very modern as a play.
Yeah, yeah.
It's deliberately bitty.
Mm.
It's throwing themes against each other, and then when something runs out of steam, let's sing a song, get everyone back on their feet, and on to the next thing.
It is. There's kind of something almost kind of, wise children-y about it.
Yeah, it has that cabaret sort of style, and again, that's what the recording where you were, if you were in front of red drapes, there was no setting apart from a couple of chairs and a microphone.
Yeah.
And, you know, more could be done with that.
Yeah.
You know, in different theatre spaces and things. But you get that sense of, especially with the induction and the prologue of, you know, the meta theatricalness.
Yes.
Marston does meta theatre. So at the same time, you've also got Ben Jonson and Decker and various other playwrights who are doing meta-theatre, primarily so they can throw shade at each other.
Mm.
And that's one of the things
that
we
lose. This
is one
of the plays in that War of the Theatres.
War of the Theatre. So we lose that as a modern audience, because there's lots of in-jokes.
Yeah.
And many, many an academic has lost their lives trying to figure out who represents who.
Yeah.
Without necessarily fully understanding that when you're doing that kind of game, everyone can be the person that you're targeting.
Yeah, yeah.
I've done this before where we did a show. Mm. I won't say its title. But I wrote this play, and the entire purpose of the play was to insult one person.
Mm.
Everyone who came to see the play, apart from a few luckless unfortunates who thought it was a thing to come and see for entertainment, was attacking this one person. But this one person had so many different nicknames for his various exploits that every character was named after him.
Yes.
So there was one person who got killed and was this person, and everybody else was also called this person.
Yeah.
And that when you are doing those kind of personal, like, wherever you fit the gag, you know, because it's an in-joke, it's a conversation with different theatre companies, with different playwrights, and it's good for business, because if you're throwing shade at another practitioner, then you probably...
But you do
so,
all the
so
time,
is this thing, is that, you know, it's like it's like stand-ups just throwing throwing material at
It's just a
we can't present to an audience.
No,
Which is why the induction is very cuttable.
Yeah,
it's very of its time.
Yeah, there's a bit. There's also a really fun bit where they refer to right at the end. They're talking about a play they've seen, and they're like, "I saw a play by St. Paul's Boys."
Yes,
and they
that's
were very,
so
the boys
meta.
Of St. Paul's, and they was very good.
Yes. So you changed that.
We
to
just
Yak.
Changed it to their to the Young Actors Company,
because it's the same gag.
It's exactly the same. Yeah. And people love it. It's but it's weird how I mean, it's understandable in the modern day, but yeah, I think the emphasis on the War of the Theatres takes you away from just the process of making the show in so many ways. It's not like I very much doubt they were talking about it all the way through rehearsals. You're talking more about things like, okay, we've got so many songs, let's get the harmonies right, and let's get some choreography down, and this massive drinking song at the end, how are we going to get people listening? Why are we even doing that?
I really, because that drinking song is a page and a half long.
It's really fascinating. They printed the whole thing.
It's not like they just mentioned there is a song here. You've got a lot of lyrics. You don't have all of the lyrics. I think some songs are mentioned. There's sort of viols play.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, there are some missing lyrics.
So there's bits and pieces. But this song, which is, you know, sing gentle butler Bally Moy.
Yeah. Give us once a drink.
But it's considering that most of it's repetition.
Yeah.
It's the fact that they print.
It doesn't need to be printed out, does it?
No.
It's maybe, I mean, maybe there's someone who knows about printing that would sort of have an argument filling for that.
Yeah. They thought it was going to cover more leaves, and they had a couple spare, so they just, the typesetter got bored.
But maybe it was really popular, and everyone wanted to have
that. Maybe that's almost the selling point for the thing, is, hey, you'll get the words to this song, and how it's structured. And
it's a huge drinking song.
Because you did. Do it.
We went for it,
and you added little physical, you know, the sort of the suicide death thing on stage that you throw in.
Oh yeah, we did. Why did we do that?
Because what I really like about your staging is that you throw in little bits of improv. So in the sort of wooing of Catherine, you've got the bit where say his name again.
Must Puff.
No, the her actual love interest.
Pasquale. Yeah.
And he sort of just goes, he sort of says half a line that he might try and go, is that right?
Yeah.
Does that work? Is that and commenting on the text as you're doing it, and it actually really worked for that. I mean, you thankfully didn't do it all the way through. I mean, they do the verse really well, because Marston is not easy.
Well, actually, I had these wonderful actors for Catherine and Pasquale called Josh and Rihanna, who were just like, they were only in year 9 and 10 at the time, but they were very, just really good at getting it.
Mm.
And it is a very funny scene, that their wooing scene. There's a bit when she goes, oh, you bite my lip. And that's
they go
difficult.
To kiss, and then it's like, oh no, too aggressive.
So
do
we,
it again.
We obviously decided that we'd go straight for the comedy there.
Yeah.
And I think you definitely would if you had two boys playing that part.
Mm.
But that was a really fun way of getting over the whole stage kiss, which is an awkward thing to rehearse.
Yeah, especially with young people.
I always hate rehearsing with young people. You feel like you're kind of, making them do something. Oh, it's terrible. But actually that gave us a way in, gave us a joke to begin with, which is fun.
Because their plot is really dark.
It gets very dark. Pasquale goes
but
mad.
Where is the tone with Marston? And this is something that, having seen Edward's Boys Malcontent, and I've seen an adult company do, the RSC did it about many years ago, which I saw, and again with Edward's Boys, of just it goes like that, from really quite dark, really it's almost self-loathing, but also, shall we say, there's some difficult issues with women, I think Marston has. So they get together. Mammon obviously doesn't like that, so he goes to commission... A murder.
Yeah, he purchases...
There's a few commissions for murder in this...
He commissions a murder, and he purchases oil of toads.
Yeah.
And that allows him to scar Catherine's face.
Yeah.
In a very dodgy sequence, actually, as we discovered whilst performing it. We didn't really realise it while we were rehearsing it, but whilst performing it, it looks like he's assaulting her, because he has to sort of hover over her and pour this oil of toads in her face.
It is a moment of going... What I mean, how violent do you make that?
Yeah, and what's he actually pouring as well? I think we just opted for glitter
oil of vitriol or something.
Yeah,
that's the idea.
But can go really mental.
But that initial murder plot of Pasquale is, he finds out that it's going to happen, and pretends to have been murdered, so that Mammon comes on and goes, "Oh, he's dead! It's great! It's great!" And he's wandering around with this blood on his face, around his his throat slit, and then he just goes, "Hello," and just rubs it in his face, which is funny.
And then John Foda King sings a song at Mammon called "Grand Sot Mammon," faux fi fi, a foutre pour vous,
and it is brilliant, because it's this constant reversal and changing direction, and then it goes in a very dark direction when he throws acid in her face, effectively.
And then that sends Pasquale mad.
That sends Pasquale mad, so there's mad scenes, but people like... But it's not interior mad scenes.
No.
It's all demonstrative. So, again, is it supposed to actually project an emotion? An emotional response? Or is it comic?
It feels just like it's playing around with, look at all the things that these kids can impersonate.
Yeah, and what theatres do, none of this is real.
No,
This whole thing is fake, because we're now going to sing a song just to break up the action.
Yeah, it's entertainment.
And
at the end, everything's fine, her face gets magically healed off stage.
Gets magically healed.
And Pasquale goes unmad.
Yeah, and Mammon loses all his money.
Yes.
And goes mad himself.
Yes.
So... And we don't care.
And then we sing a drinking song.
And then everyone sings a drinking song. And you get the cuckold's horns on the poor unfortunate cuckold, and the Frenchman got his end away, so he's happy.
I think John Ellis is meant to sing the drinking song at the end, or is meant to lead it, and he also is meant to sing a song while he's wooing Camellia. John Ellis is one of the wooers. He's meant to be really stupid but very rich. He obviously doesn't get her in the end. Brabant Jr. does. And just it happened in our production that the balance of musical talent was elsewhere, so we redistributed those songs. But I always find that interesting when you have one person who's got a really small part but then a huge song that doesn't relate to their character, and it's just this kid can sing.
With the kids' companies as well, especially the odds on the world that the singing is
Is
a major part. He's, he's like, no, we need to put a song in because we've got this great boy singer. And you know, let's use that talent.
So John Ellis was probably one of the great singers of the company at the time.
I mean, what I'd really, what appeals to me about actually quite a few Marston plays is there is a central plot, and then there's all this stuff going on around it. And for me, when I don't have many actors a lot of the time, and I want to do live shows, is that I could sort of pick a subplot here and weave it into part of the live radio show. And if I've got some music as well, you know, Marston is infinitely adaptable for my core, hopefully my core live show practice. So, you know, and the advantage of having now watched your version as well as having read it is I now get it. I now get the play in the way I did not before. You know, reading a play like this, you know, reading a lot of plays is really tedious. But you know, some are very literary and work quite well that way. This does not. It does not. It's not a play to read. It's a play to do. And like Malcontent, Malcontent has the central plot is only about three, four characters. You could actually cut away. But you know, the playing around with language and and that comedy foreign.
Comedy, foreign characters, smoking, acid in the face, loads of songs. It is. I completely agree. It's like it's a series of tasks. Doing this play, it's like a series of challenges. Can you pull them all off? That's the way it seemed to us, anyway. And I suppose at the time they probably just chose challenges they knew they could do.
You know, there are plots. There are. I've got here incidents versus plot. You know, there's a lot of incident.
And you could cut quite a lot of it.
That's the thing is I could happily cull this into three or four different 45-minute shows. You know, I could follow the central plot, or I could go with a cuckolding plot, or I could break it up with a bit of narration. And you've got an entertainment. And it's like the infinite variety of Jack Drum's entertainment.
Yeah, it feels, it reminds me a lot of kind of modern youth theatre, where you're doing a kind of like, look how wild and talented and...
let's show all their talents.
Let's show all their talents, and let's also kind of be slightly nostalgic about the freedom and willfulness of youth. And so, yeah, so if there is this kind of schoolboy kind of theme, like the kind of learning and arguments running through, that's definitely being offset by just reckless abandon and a kind of playfulness with that. I don't know if you know What You Will, but that was written very soon.
It was a little later, I think. In the general area.
In the general area, and that's another Marston play that plays around a lot with, like, I mean, that has specific schoolboy school education scenes, which would be madness to stage.
That's really interesting. But I like the idea of giving actors games.
Yes, definitely.
And that seems to be something that's going on here, is that there are games being played.
Yeah.
The actors are given, you know, tasks to do in this scene. Yes, you've got dialogue, but you do the task as well.
In terms of the modern acting terminology, game is something you give to kind of in clown acting as well. And it can be quite similar to an action in method acting.
Yes.
Just a thing to do. And this is a play full of things to do. And in that regard, you can't go wrong. You need someone to come in and pour wine. You need someone to pour acid. You need some people to kiss and then bite. You know, it's just loads of actions and they're really clear.
Yeah.
Loads of games.
That sort of open performance style, the music, the language. They coped really well because I think Marston is quite opaque.
Yeah.
There's something, he's working the language really hard.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a challenge for an actor, and that's great, but sometimes it is just like a wall of words hitting you in the face.
Yeah, far too many neologisms.
And, you know, he shares that with his rival, like, you know, Johnson, where there's the same density of stuff. I mean, it makes up for it, I think, because there's so much physical fun other stuff going on, and the context is clear.
Yeah.
But yeah, that, I mean, that is. I think that's the challenge for any producer of these plays is that that initial getting people comfortable with the language. I think you did get them comfortable with the language. It felt natural.
Oh, good. Well, we obviously spent quite a while just figuring out what things meant and doing the whole translate the line into modern English.
Yeah. So what was the process for putting it together? I mean, how long did you have? Probably not a lot.
Not
of time.
A lot. We had about, I think we had about 16 rehearsals, which could be worse.
Mm-hmm.
Very quickly, those were dominated by learning the songs and teaching the songs to the singers and to the musicians. They'd never done a show before where they had to sing or play music, so there was just all the kind of confidence in getting them to sing loudly and stuff. Mm. They sing very quietly at first, but they all sang well. We would tend to do songs for about half a rehearsal, and then in the early stages of looking at scenes, we would just like it was actually quite round table to start off with. I don't know if I would do that now, but it was let's sit down and let's go through it line by line and just figure out what's going on and what you are saying, and then we just put it on his feet.
There's some really, I mean, there's some bits where it's almost like he's not trying.
The Morris dance.
I forgot to mention Morris dancing. Because I was going, where is that? I didn't see it.
Well, I'd forgotten about that because I cut it. Yeah, and that's another example of a mad challenge. I'll just throw in a Morris dance. I'd love to have included it because Morris dances are so symbolic and interesting, and that's the kind of game you play with each other. It's a kind of fight, isn't it? It's sort of before a sword fight.
The other thing it reminds me of, because, again, because we're doing it, not like this is a plug for future production, because the Old Wives' Tale. Which is a very short storytelling-y type thing. So it's, again, that very open storytelling theatre of, you know, and I'm telling you a story. Oh, shit, they've come on stage. And that's got random singing foresters.
Yeah.
And it is literally random. They have no connection with anything. They just walk on stage singing a song and then walk off again. And it's just like, and the point of that is basically the audience to get, as far as I can tell, his early days, future Robert may disagree with current Robert.
Yeah.
It was just go, what the fuck?
Yeah.
What was that? That was fun, but why did that happen?
It depends what the tone of a, what the actual vibe of a Morris dance is. In that, I don't know if there are multiple, I don't know anything about Morris dances.
Well, it could be a very sexually charged thing.
It definitely breaks up the mood.
Hypothetically, that's it should be.
And it occurs during this, or just after this discussion between Sir Edward Fortune and Mammon, which is quite long, it's quite big speechy. And so it sort of
wakes the audience
punches
up
through that, and also just kind of gets a sense of rivalry and of like youthful exuberance. And it's also, it's an ensemble bit, isn't it? After some more lead actory bits.
Yeah.
And so it keeps on coming, you know, structurally, I suppose, it goes, the basic structure is some non-ensemble bits followed by some ensemble bits followed by some non-ensemble bits, and that's quite a good structure.
It's a good structure. I mean, it's
means no one falls asleep backstage.
Well, again, it's a similar pattern. Every so often, you just throw a different random thing.
Yeah,
just to wake everybody
engaged,
up.
But it's also good for keeping the actors engaged.
Yeah,
and it means your rehearsals aren't. You don't have to do partial rehearsing very often. You just go like everyone. We need everyone the whole time, which is kind of good.
Yeah, and everyone's able to bounce off. You know, going back to that whole thing of tone. Because, you know, some of this is very dark and very sexual. And, of course, we're probably a lot more concerned about that. But actually, to be fair, in the time, some people were quite concerned, but a little bit porny. Because, you know, some of the invective and some of the language is you know, does got written down. Does Marston have a problem with women? Is what I got written down here. Because there's a sort of attraction, excitement, but revulsion at the same time.
Yes.
Thing going on.
The way Camellia's treated is quite mean.
Yeah.
And Catherine just gets scarred and then magically healed.
Yeah, that doesn't read well today.
No.
But did it read well then? I mean, it's so extreme.
Yeah.
And it's, oh, she's just healed. And it's fine.
In terms of, well, there's another character, which is Winifred, who is Camellia's kind of maid, and she's your classic gossip, and she's manipulative and is always trying to set Camellia up with someone else who she can then pocket the bribe from. And I mean, obviously, this isn't a positive character, but she's got a kind of cheeky power, and she doesn't get a comeuppance. She is quite empowered, and she's a really interesting, like, lower class woman. I don't know if it's because these are, you know, rich daughters who are potentially objects of satire. You know, I don't know if it's as much. It could be more about, like, the powerful and those who are naturally rich who he's satirising. Whereas Winifred, I think, has a fantastic arc. It would be quite fun to play. Does that make sense?
Yes, that does make sense. I whether it makes sense to the listener at home, I don't know. But then, you know, tough watch the thing. Do your work. Come on. We're not going to feed everything to you on a plate. Yeah, I know. I mean, would you do it again?
I'd love to tackle it again. Yeah.
Because now you know.
Now I get what's going on. I mean, this is
the thing.
Is,
the great thing for me is I don't need to discover the things you've sort of told me. Well, and I can agree and disagree with some of the things you do. Fine. You know, you've made some cuts. I might not make those cuts. You've cut the Morris dancing. I might spend. I might put more in.
I'd love to tackle it again because I've been working now with this same group for 4 years.
Yeah.
And as I say, that was the first show we did, and they've just gone from strength to strength. And it feels like now we actually are ready to make a really good Jack Drums Entertainment and to really make those songs contrast. I probably would try cutting nothing. You know, that'd be mad, wouldn't it?
I don't know, just to treat it like a real variety show. I think the 2-hour running time you achieved is an admirable number.
It's a lot.
It could drift happily to 2.5.
I have to say, on the cutting front,
that much cut, I thought.
No, it really wasn't, and I probably would have cut more. There. But I was very uncertain. I'd never tried a show like this before with kids, and so I was asking around, and someone called Elizabeth Dutton, who is a friend who runs early drama at Oxford, she recommended filleting, as she put it, rather than cutting scenes, just on grounds that if you fill it, then you're not potentially getting rid of something that you haven't even tried. And the only thing I didn't even try was the Morris dance, because I'm just aware that would take, knock out at least a day of our rehearsal process. At least.
Yeah. Well, at least you didn't cut the songs. I mean, that's the thing, is that with a lot of drama, you know, you've got, now they sing, I'll cut that.
Because when you try it, you figure out what it's like. And the songs, I'm really glad we stuck with those.
But it is a huge investment. You've got to commit to, you know, pretty much all the songs, you know, all music as an integral part of this play. And I think if you take the music out...
Yeah. And we were lucky to have
the thing falls apart.
Yeah. Yeah, we were really lucky to have a brilliant composer called Dylan Townley, who can do anything, and he writes songs incredibly fast, and he's brilliant at teaching kids as well. And he had a lot of fun, particularly I think writing the drinking song and all the songs that John Foda King sings, and making those into kind of, like, you know, fun French pastiche songs. They were a real delight. I still sing them to myself sometimes. And we tried, and we actually made the mad decision. So there's a song which we called "Bless His Eyes," which is sung by Master Puff up to Camellia's balcony.
Yes.
To try to persuade her to love him. Oh, actually, Master Puff. Maybe he's trying to woo Catherine. Maybe I've got that the wrong way around.
There's some wooing.
There's a
wooing song,
and it's "Bless His Eyes," and I think it's fairly clearly in the text meant to be. A rubbish song. But we were very soft, and all the other songs that we were doing were quite kind of caricatured and massive. Like Mammon has a song about how rich he is, and John Foda King sings like some mockery songs of Mammon. And so we made "Bless His Eyes" tried to make it into a kind of romantic anthem that we actually feel quite strongly about. And then we kind of wafted on Catherine in she was carried on as if she was kind of in a romantic bower. So that was a decision, a directorial decision, because we just wanted something that wasn't satire, which maybe shows we felt very overwhelmed by how satirical the whole piece was to our eyes anyway.
And that, again, it's the thing that, going back to the cuts, is, you know, with, you know, He Who Must Not Be Named,
Voldemort.
renowned early modern playwright. With Shakespeare, if you want to look at a play, you can watch it, you can sing, there are pre-cut versions that exist.
Yeah.
And you have this very weird examples when a production of Hamlet, you'll see in the credits, I can't remember which one it was it the one before or after the Benedict Cumberbatch?
Oh, right, the Andrew Scott one.
Yeah, I can't remember. One of them had a title coming up saying, based on the script cut for X production a few years earlier.
Oh, right.
So it's like almost there's an established route of cutting.
Yeah.
That exists. And
it's its own tradition.
There's an edition of some of the history plays that are cut down. The Plantagenets that the IRC did ages ago. And
yeah.
So there's that cut with some elided dialogue and things and some adjustments.
Yeah. And you just don't have that.
Yeah.
These plays. Yeah.
No, I mean, hell, it's hard enough just getting a copy. I mean, we're looking at from archive.org, and this is a facsimile.
Yeah, I typed it up.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is, you know, it's just a nightmare to get a copy of.
I wonder if some of the filleting decisions I made were partly just because I was bored of typing that scene.
Well, that's the thing. I'm very much hoping that I'll be able to be in a position when we come around to doing it that we can...
You can have it.
That'd be lovely. Thank God I don't have to do go through. Because, seriously, I want to do... It will go at one of our live radio shows sometime in the next year or so.
Mm.
We'll do either just some best bits of Marston show, which will just be very light and frothy. But also we might do just a cut down, condensed version of individual plays. So The Malcontent, I could do a really neat 45-minute pricey version of that. And I think actually Jack Drum could work in various different ways.
Yeah. It would be different plays. Jack Drums. You could... Yes. Yeah.
This is... What we'd like to try and put out there is, you know, is that sharing our work is what makes it easier for the next person to do things.
Yeah,
and that we don't mind that. And if you out there, dear listener, have been involved in a production, no matter what scale, you know, amateur, professional, whatever, and you've got material and you would like to share it, then please do. And if you don't know how to do it, get in touch with me. I'll help. We'll put it out there.
And if you watch this production of Jack Drums Entertainment, which is on YouTube, and
links
on
the, will be applied in the show notes,
and all that, and you fancy having a stab at it yourself, then and you want to chat to me, I'd love to chat about it, and I'd love to see what someone else does with the play.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that everyone who's done it already will be delighted to come and see whatever you do with it, as long as you are geographically relatively close. But you know, if you record it and put that online as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it's multiple versions with a text, which actually I think could be... You could take this in so many different directions.
Yeah, yeah.
You could make it much darker.
Mm.
Much, much darker.
Yeah. And you could also... You could make it much more kind of satirical and acerbic, but fun. Again, it was hard. It was hard to apply... Really hard to apply a concept to this show.
Yeah.
Because it, you know, it doesn't feel particularly... of any periods. It just feels like musical.
Yeah, so that idea of, you know, maybe interfering with the text occasionally to bring up some more modern satires would be quite fun.
Yeah, you could definitely do that, couldn't you? Yeah.
And so that's a really interesting route that appeals. I mean, there's also geography, because, you know, it's quite... It has a location.
Yeah.
Was it Highgate?
Yeah.
So there's a sense of... It has a specific logic...
Yeah, yeah, it's all set on the hill, overlooking. Sir Edward Fortune's house that is being referred to was a real house. There's sort of questions of that,
and you know that people would know what this meant and how that related to class and structure and class and structure. Class structure.
Yeah.
There we are. Why did I put the and in? I don't. That'll be edited out later. It's really. You've done well, sir.
Thanks, man. It's nice that someone's watched it.
Yeah, it's had a few hundred, and I'm sure we can up that. That's the thing, is it just every little helps.
Mm.
And, you know, for everything that worked and did work is you know, an idea that hopefully someone might take away. If something didn't work, then they can ignore it, and that's the other great thing. I think the only thing to say to the casual viewer is you do need to give it a bit of a moment to get in.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that opening scene.
Well, without the induction, without the induction to fuel
to set that up. But I'd almost write my own. You'd almost say after Marston. With a lot of prologues, because they're very time-specific.
Yeah.
Is you can almost take the theme and then rewrite it, I feel, sometimes.
I kept wondering if I would, and then just ran out of time.
Yeah.
I would have loved to have done that. And if anyone is interested in... This is my own minor plug.
Yeah.
If anyone is interested in like, seeing how they progress as a company, the following year, so the next show we did, it's pretty much the same group. Some people left, some people joined. We did Supposes by George Gascoigne,
which we will talk about at some point.
And that's also on YouTube.
Yes. So
and that is just a static camera, but I think you can see they've come quite a long way.
Yeah.
It's very interesting how quickly they progress.
Yes.
Hmm.
You give them challenges.
Yeah.
Yeah. Push them.
Yeah.
And they will fly.
Yeah.
Or they'll fall splat and, you know, it's fine.
No, they all flew. No one splatted.
No, nobody splatted. No, any additional thoughts? I think we sort of danced through that.
We have danced through loads of stuff.
Yeah.
It's a really eclectic show.
Whether anyone can follow this, I will write an introduction once I've listened to it.
I think the form of this conversation has really reflected the madness of the show.
Yeah.
It's very digressive.
Yeah, that you move around and hopefully we keep it light and frothy, and hopefully this was entertaining.
Yes, to listen to. With some dark moments.
Do you want to just do a plug for yourself about yourself generally? Where can you be found online if you want to be found online or things like that? Anything you want to say about yourself?
I don't really have an online presence.
Do you not?
No. I mean, most of the time at the moment, I'm directing for the Young Actors Company. You can always email me, sam@theyoungactorscompany.com, if you want to ask about any of the shows we're doing. And I've also got my own show called Fanny and Stella, which is about the lives of two Victorian transvestite musician performers, Fanny and Stella, or Ernest and Freddie, who were real and were involved in the trial of the century. And we've made a kind of two-man clownish musical about their lives. And our Twitter handle is @FannyandStella, rather predictably. So that is my only online presence. But that's actually run by Dylan, who plays Stella. No, he plays Fanny, I play Stella. Yeah.
And that's it for this discussing episode, and I'd like to thank Sam Plum for talking with me and sharing some memories of his production. I'd also like to thank Rob Meissen for playing the Tireman in the introduction. If you want to watch the play on YouTube or follow other links on the play, look in the show notes, or just Google Jack Drums Entertainment. I mean, seriously, we have the internet now. You don't need me to spoon-feed you everything. Till next time, I've been your host, Robert Crichton, and you've been listening to the Beyond Shakespeare podcast. Support us today by going to www.patreon.com/beyondshakespeare, or perhaps leave a review, or 5 stars, preferably, on iTunes or other podcast reviewing sites.
Right, well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir.
I will switch off the recorder now.
Groovy.
Or will I?
I'm going to cut some aubergines.
Ooh, yes, you cut your aubergines.